You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 574. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 574. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Go to ESLPOD.com. and become a member of this podcast. When you do, you can download the 8 to 10 page learning guides we provide for all of our recent episodes. On this cafe, we're going to talk about a classic television show that was later made into a series of movies, Mission Impossible. We'll also talk about a famous photographer from the 20th century, Alfred Stieglitz. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. In 1966, the television show Mission, Impossible, introduced audiences, people watching television, to a group of trained agents, people working for a government, who did things that seemed impossible. The group of agents worked in an organization that was considered very secret. Nobody knew about it. The word mission, M-I-S-S-I-O-N, is used in a couple of different ways in the title of the TV series, Mission Impossible. It meant an important assignment, an important job that you had to do. In the army, in the military, the word mission is used to describe a certain set of actions, usually limited in time, that a group of soldiers carry out or execute, do. The word mission is also used sometimes in a religious context to refer to a group of people who go out and try to either convert or to give religious instruction to other people. The word mission is used in business to talk about the larger purposes of the business, what the business is trying to accomplish, what they're trying to do. I mentioned that in the TV series Mission Impossible, there were a set or group of trained agents, trained, T-R-A-I-N-E-D, means you have been given or taught a certain set of skills or given a certain amount of knowledge that will allow you to do something. An agent is a person who, in this case, works for a government, often in a capacity or doing the job of law enforcement or something related to the military. We have agents who work for the Central Intelligence Agency. We have agents who work for the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We have Secret Service agents who work for the Homeland Security Department that help protect the President of the United States. all of these people are called agents. In the TV show Mission Impossible, just as in the later movies, some of which you may have seen, the show always began with the agents getting a set of instructions, a list of things that they had to do. The instructions usually were on a recording. Back in the television show, it was a tape recording. And the instructions always began with the words, "Your mission, should you choose to accept it." To accept means to agree to do something, to say yes. The instructions were, of course, secret messages to the leader of this team of highly trained agents. I don't think anyone ever said no. I don't think any of the agents ever said, "Nah, I don't really want to do that." They always say yes. The agents belonged to the secret organization called the Impossible Missions Force, or IMF, a force, F-O-R-C-E, is an organization with some sort of military purpose or something that is part of the police. We sometimes, in fact, refer to the police as the police force, the group of police officers in a certain area. The leader of the IMF, not to be confused with the International Monetary Fund, which is also known by the initials IMF, was a man by the name of Jim Phelps. On the show, he was played by a wonderful actor named Peter Graves. The other members of the team included Barney Collier, played by another good actor, Greg Morris. The character Barney Collier was very good at using high-tech devices and machines that would help the mission. The term high-tech, T-E-C-H, refers to machines that use very advanced technology. This was a theme of the show, that they would use this new advanced technology, sort of similar to what the James Bond series was doing in England and, of course, later in the movies that were made. Technology was an important part of carrying out the mission. Of course, there was a good-looking woman who was part of the IMF. The character in the original series was called Cinnamon Carter. I love that name. Cinnamon is a kind of spice that is used in flavoring food. I guess we could call her one of the first Spice Girls. She was good looking and smart, and she used both of those things to help her help the mission be successful. Finally, there was also Rollin Hand, played by Martin Landau, who was a master of disguise. Disguise, D-I-S-G-U-I-S-E, refers to something you use to change the way you look so no one knows who you are. In the later movies that starred Tom Cruise, some of these characters were combined into one so that Tom Cruise plays a character who does all sorts of things that the individual characters did in the original series. In the TV show, the roles or characters each had an important part of the mission. It wasn't so much about one star as it became when the movies were made later on. In each mission of Mission Impossible, the entire team, the entire group, would travel somewhere in the world in order to carry out or to execute their mission. Sometimes they would fight the bad guys. Sometimes they would get people who were hostages released. A hostage, H-O-S-T-A-G-E, T-A-G-E, is a person who is taken by another person or group of people and held basically as a prisoner against his wishes. Remember that the IMF was a secret organization, and so the government could never say that it was in fact behind the missions that were carried out by this group. So the instructions for the mission that you heard at the beginning of the show would end in the same way. The instructions would say, as always, should you or any of your IM force be caught or killed, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. Good luck, Jim. Jim was, of course, the character, Jim Phelps, the leader of the team. The recording would end, this tape, the recording tape, will self-destruct in 5 seconds. So the last part of the instructions always told the leader, Jim, that if something bad happens to his team, the government, the secretary, the leader of this secret organization, would disavow any knowledge of their actions. To disavow, D-I-S-A-V-O-W, means that you deny that you know anything about a certain person, or that you say, I'm not going to support this person. Sometimes in politics, people will disavow another person who is unpopular or who says something they don't want to be connected to. They don't want anyone to think that they agree with this person, so they disavow the person. Well, the secretary, the leader of this secret organization, says he will disavow any knowledge of the actions of the team because, of course, the government doesn't want to admit that it is giving money and supporting this secret organization. The tape always self-destructs after the instructions are heard. To self-destruct means that it destroys itself. So what you would see on the original TV show is that the tape would start to burn. Now, we don't know exactly how that happened, but we all believe that there was some sort of secret technology that would allow the tape to self-destruct. That verb, to self-destruct, is sometimes used also to describe someone who does something that hurts himself, who takes actions that are harmful to the person himself. If someone says, he is self-destructive, or his behavior, his actions are self-destructive, the person means that what he is doing is going to be harmful to himself, not to anyone else. Mission Impossible was on television for many years, from 1966 until 1973, and was very popular with audiences. I used to watch the show growing up. My older brothers and sisters liked watching the show. I was a little young to understand it, but the show was shown even after 1973 in what we call reruns, R-E-R-U-N-S. A rerun is when a television show is no longer being produced. There are no new shows, but the television channels, nowadays the cable channels, continue to show the program. One of the things that made people want to watch the show was the special effects. Special effects refers to things in a TV show or movie that use technology to make you think something amazing is happening, often by using special computers nowadays. As often happens in Los Angeles, here in Hollywood, the movie studios get interested in something that has already been proven successful. And since everyone liked the Mission Impossible television shows, several years later, they decided to start making Mission Impossible movies, which I referred to earlier, starring Tom Cruise. You've probably seen some of the movies, but you may not have been aware that there were also these TV shows. I'm not sure if you can find these on the internet nowadays, but if you can, you might enjoy them. Of course, the technology will be very different, will not be as sophisticated or as advanced as what you see in the movies, but the plots, the stories of the shows were usually pretty good, were usually entertaining. Now let's turn to our second topic, an American photographer. Alfred Stieglitz was born on the 1st of January in 1864 in Hoboken, New Jersey. Hoboken is a small town that is across the Hudson River from New York City. New Jersey, of course, is next to the state of New York on the east coast of the United States. Hoboken later became famous for being the town where one of the great American singers of the 20th century was born, Frank Sinatra. Alfred Stieglitz's family had a lot of money. His father had emigrated from Germany and ran a very successful clothing business. In 1871, the family moved across the river to New York City, and that's where Stieglitz spent most of his life. Stieglitz later went back to his father's native Germany, to Berlin, to study at the university. He went to the school in Berlin that specialized in engineering, which is basically the branch of science that deals with designing and building things. Stieglitz soon realized that he wasn't really very interested in engineering. I also went to the university thinking I was going to study engineering. Well, actually, my father wanted me to study engineering at the University of Minnesota, but I didn't really want to. It didn't interest me very much, and so I never did. So Stieglitz and I have something in common, you see. However, Stieglitz did not become a podcaster. He instead got interested in photography. In 1887, he won first and second prize at a photography competition that was held by an English magazine called Amateur Photographer. An amateur is someone who doesn't get paid to do something. Stieglitz returned to the United States in 1890 and began trying to get people in the art world to think of photography, which was, of course, relatively new in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, to think of photography as an art, as a serious form of artistic expression, like painting or sculpture. He became editor of a small photography magazine by the name of Camera Notes, an editor, E-D-I-T-O-R, of a magazine or a newspaper is the person in charge of that publication, the person who is responsible for being the director or manager of the organization. Stieglitz became known, however, as a very difficult person to work with. He didn't get along with other people very well. He was a difficult person to have to work with or work under, that is, have as your boss. So eventually, he had to resign or leave his position as editor. In 1902, he formed or created his own photography group or club called Photo Secession. Secession, S-E-C-E-S-S-I-O-N, is not related as a term to photography at all. We usually use this term in politics or in talking about governments. Secession is when you formally leave an organization or, more commonly, a country. In the U.S., the states in the South tried to secede from the Union of States. They tried to separate themselves. They were not, however, successful because they lost the war that began because they tried to separate themselves. Stieglitz's club, Photo Secession, however, referred more to the fact that he was separating himself from the other photographers and trying to do something completely new. There was a similar movement that was taking place among artists in Germany and Austria during this same period, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Many of the photographers in Stieglitz's club used a certain style of photography called pictorialism, P-I-C-T-O-R-I-A-L-I-S-M. Pictorialism is related to the word picture, and as you might guess, members of this movement tried to make their photographs look more like paintings, look more like pictures that were made in a more traditional way. Sometimes they did this by making the photograph less clear than it would otherwise be, sort of like some of the paintings during this same period, if you think about the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists, how these are not perfect representations of reality, but rather interpretations of reality. The Photo Secession Club published a magazine every 3 months called Camera Work. The magazine was published between 1903 and 1917 and became very influential. People were influenced by the ideas and the photographs that appeared in the magazine. Stieglitz also opened his own art gallery, or photograph gallery, in 1905, and that gave him space, that gave him room to show photographs and paintings and sculptures. The gallery came to be called 291 because it was located at 291 Fifth Avenue in New York City. Over the years, Stieglitz showed more than just photographs in his art gallery. He showed famous pieces of art from artists such as Toulouse-Lautrec, Matisse, Cézanne, and Picasso. He didn't just show other people's works, however. He continued taking photographs himself. These photographs were also shown in his art gallery. Strangely, Stieglitz changed his mind later in his career. He decided to go back to showing reality, representing reality as it really was in his photographs. That is to say, he basically abandoned or left pictorialism and the whole photo secessionist movement. Eventually, his magazine stopped publishing and his gallery was closed. Before that happened, however, he met a young painter. In fact, even before he met the young painter, he saw her works and decided that he would exhibit or show her paintings in his gallery, even without asking her permission. When the young painter found out about it, she went to his gallery and was not very happy with him. As soon as Stieglitz met this young painter, however, he fell in love with her. She did not fall in love with him, at least right away. he was 23 years older than she was. She was in, that is to say, her mid-20s, and he was in his 40s. But eventually the two of them did fall in love, and in 1924 they got married. That young painter's name was Georgia O'Keeffe. If you know something about 20th century American art, you will probably have heard of Georgia O'Keeffe. She became one of the best known painters of the 20th century in the U.S. Stieglitz continued photographing not just his new beautiful young wife, Georgia O'Keeffe, but also the city where he lived in New York. He's remembered today for photographs of both of those subjects. He died in 1946 in New York at the age of 82. O'Keeffe herself remained in New York for a few more years, but by this time she had fallen in love with the state of New Mexico and returned there to live permanently until her death 40 years later in 1986. Now let's answer some of the questions you have sent to us. Our first question comes from Haruna, H-A-R-U-N-A, in Japan. The question has to do with the difference between satisfactory and satisfying. Both of these words come from the word satisfy, S-A-T-I-S-F-Y. To satisfy means to make someone happy or to please someone. To satisfy can also mean to do what is required of you, to satisfy the requirements for going to college, you may need to study math, science, and languages. In order to meet or satisfy the requirements, you have to do certain things. That's the verb to satisfy. Satisfactory is an adjective that means it's good enough for a certain purpose. It satisfies, that is, a certain requirement. Often satisfactory is used, however, to mean that it's good enough, it's okay, but perhaps it isn't great. If someone says, your work is satisfactory, he's saying, well, it's good, what you do is good, it's good enough, you're not going to get fired, you're not going to lose your job, but perhaps it could be better. That is sometimes the implication when someone says something is satisfactory. We sometimes use the expression satisfactory progress to talk about a student in school who's getting good grades, who's getting good enough grades, I should say, but perhaps isn't the best student in the world. Satisfying, S-A-T-I-S-F-Y-I-N-G, is another adjective that means that something gives you all that you want or need. This adjective is typically used to describe some sort of pleasure that you get from either eating or participating in some activity. If you say, for example, that the movie I saw last night was very satisfying in an emotional way, that is, it gave me what I wanted to get from the movie. You could describe a meal, a dinner, say, at a restaurant, as being very satisfying. It was good. It gave me the taste that I wanted to get, perhaps. Alexic, A-L-E-K-S-E-K, in Russia, wants to know the difference between two expressions, damaged goods and majorly unfair. Let's start with damaged, D-A-M-A-G-E-D, goods, G-O-O-D-S. Something that has been damaged has been either broken or harmed in some way so that it is no longer as good as it was or no longer functioning the way it should. Goods refers in general to things that you buy. We might also use the term products. Goods are typically physical objects that are bought. The opposite of goods are services. Services are what people do. So if, for example, you go and buy some shoes, you are buying some goods. If you go and pay money to a lawyer to help you with a certain legal problem, you are buying services or paying for services. The lawyer does something for you, usually not as useful as a pair of boots, which you could buy at the store. Damaged goods refers either to an object that is broken, but more commonly in conversational English, it has a different meaning. It refers to a man or a woman who has perhaps been emotionally harmed in a previous relationship and therefore not a good potential romantic partner. That's a more informal meaning, but perhaps more common than the literal meaning of damaged goods. It is, in a way, sort of a cruel expression to say that a woman or a man is damaged goods because he or she has gone through a difficult, say, separation or divorce or breakup from a relationship, but it is a term that people use. The second expression is majorly, M-A-J-O-R-L-Y, unfair, U-N-F-A-I-R. Something that is fair is something that is just, something that is right. Something that is unfair is something that is unjust, something that seems wrong or seems as though it is discriminatory, perhaps, against one person or harms a person or group of people in a way that doesn't seem right, that isn't justified by his or her actions or their actions. Majorly is an informal way of saying very or very much so. Majorly is a word that would probably be used more by a teenager, let's say, than an adult in a normal conversation. Majorly unfair, then, would be something that would be very unfair, something that would be very unjust. Your teenage daughter might say that it's majorly unfair that she has to come back home by 10 o'clock in the evening every night. Finally, Amir, A-M-I-R, in Iran, wants to know the meaning of the expression to kill someone with kindness, K-I-N-D-N-E-S-S. To be kind is to be nice, is to be good to another person. Kindness, then, is a noun that expresses the state of or the situation in which someone is kind. To kill someone with kindness means to be nice to someone in such a way that you are in fact damaging or hurting them, especially when someone has not been kind to you. You are going to be nice to them almost as a way of punishing them or almost as a way of showing them that you're a better person because you're going to be very kind to them. Now, it can also just mean being very kind to someone because perhaps you want something from that person. So you're going to be extra kind to them. You're going to be kind in every possible way. perhaps to get some sort of advantage from that relationship. You might also kill someone with kindness just to change the person, to get the person to like you more. All of those are possibilities. If you have a question or comment, there's a possibility we'll answer it here on the English Cafe. Just email us at ESLPOD@ESLPOD.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thanks for listening. Come back and listen to us again right here on the English Cafe.
ESL Podcast English Cafe was written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Sade.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by the Center for Educational Development.